Our last case today is Chamberlain Group, Inc. v. ITC, appeal number 20-1965. Mr. Dowd, when you're ready, you may begin.
May it please the court, Jim Dowd on behalf of Chamberlain. In this case, the ALJ at the ID level committed the same basic error for two patents, both the 404 patent and the 223 patent. In her Markman orders, she correctly rejected Nortec's attempt to import limitations that the claims do not recite. But then in her initial determination, the ID, she committed the error that her Markman order avoided. For the 404 patent, she imported a head unit requirement into the term movable barrier operator, or MBO. And for the 223 patent, she imported a works or functions requirement into operates. Now, the commission rightly corrected the error for the 223 patent, but failed to go far enough, should have also corrected that error for the 404.
Do I remember correctly that the 223 patent really is subject of the cross appeal?
It is. And
I wonder whether you should discuss that later.
I will, Your Honor. I just wanted to kind of frame the issues. And I want to address the 404 patent now and reserve 8 minutes for response on the cross appeal.
Can I ask you one other question, just very quickly? Your opening brief identifies a number of terms, one of which you've already used today, as being confidential. Are any of the words in your opening brief confidential?
My understanding is that the words of the briefing are not confidential.
Okay. So we don't need to worry about the words that are highlighted as in yellow as being confidential in your opening brief. Now, they're not in the other briefs. I just want to make sure.
My understanding is that those terms were identified below, but Nortec has since agreed that they're in the briefs.
Great.
They're not confidential.
So we don't have to worry about any of the confidentiality stuff.
I believe not, and I'm going to keep my – I will attempt to keep my argument at that level.
Well, it's important also for an opinion, right? I mean, so the question, even if you keep yourself from saying them, we need to know what we can and cannot say.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
So are any of the words confidential?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, no.
Thank you.
So turning now to the movable barrier operator, the central issue for the 404 patent is the construction of this term, which I'll refer to MBO as for short. That issue is subject to de novo review, and that issue would resolve, under the correct construction, all of the issues for the 404 patent.
How do we know that what we really have is a pure issue of claim construction as opposed to an application of the construction plain manner meaning, which might be reviewed for substantial evidence?
Because that is what the ALJ below said in two or three ways. First, in her ID, she specifically, under a heading that says the claimed, this is at A73, the claimed movable barrier operator does not encompass a wall station.
Where is this, Mr. Dunn?
A73, Your Honor?
A73.
She's referring to the claim, and the term movable barrier operator, in quotes, is the claim term. She then goes on and makes it abundantly clear, and now this is at A102, and I'm citing her note.
What about page A76?
A76.
Yeah, at the top of the page.
I don't have it memorized, Your Honor, but I believe she's at that stage. Is that where she's saying in the?
No, I was looking at the description of Figure 5. Look at the top of page A76. It says Figure 5 : that there's some language. Figure 1 of the 404 patent annotated to emphasize that, comma, as a matter of claim construction, comma, movable barrier operator is distinct from wall station.
I would certainly agree that's an indication that she's engaging in claim construction.
And so Your Honor, your other site was 101?
102, note 24. And there she says in the footnote, the last line, quote, as a matter of claim construction, the, quote, movable barrier operator, close quote, which possesses the claimed processor, does not encompass a wall station. So that is very clearly a revised claim construction that she then applies, and that's why I believe it is subject to de novo review. Resolving that claim construction, fixing that error, would resolve all of the issues in the case.
Why isn't her claim construction correct when every single embodiment in the patent, the processor is located in the head unit, at least in the embodiments depicted?
First, we would start with the claim language. In the claims, what the claims say is a movable barrier operator connected to control the movement of the barrier with or without an alarm. Connected to control. That is how the claim defines what the movable barrier is. And it then goes on to say the movable barrier operator comprising, open-ended, allows for different types of configurations. The movable barrier comprising, operator comprising, a communication connection, that's limitation 11B, and a processor, and that's limitations 11C through F. So long as you have a communication connection and you have a processor, and those two components are connected to control the movement of the barrier while alarming or not alarming, that is what the claim requires.
The processor alone can't move the barrier. It has to control some sort of something that moves the barrier. Right?
But the claim is very specific about this. The claim does not recite any box. It doesn't recite a head unit. It doesn't recite a wall station. It doesn't even recite a motor. What it says is you have two components, a processor and a communication connection.
Even if it had another element in it, does it say anything about a singular housing?
It does not. It doesn't say anything about a singular housing in the claim, no. It only says you have to have these two elements, a processor that does the detecting and effecting, or the determining and effecting limitations, and a communication connection. And those can be anywhere. They don't have to be physically located in a single box. They can be distributed so long as they are connected to control the movement, and then alarm or not alarm, based on the communication connection that issues the command.
You did not propose that as a construction below, though.
We certainly did. We certainly did, Your Honor. We argued that the claim term should be given its plain meaning. Movable barrier operator does not restrict to a head unit. It doesn't restrict to a wall station. And instead, we argued specifically that it is these two components connected to control. That was the issue in the Markman briefing. And actually, you can see that by looking to the Markman briefing. Nortec argued specifically about the head unit, and the processor couldn't be in the wall station 40. That's at A10164. We responded saying, no, the concept of a head unit appears nowhere in the claims, and that Nortec was, quote, presumably trying to manufacture a non-infringement position by isolating the apparatus of Claim 11 to a head unit.
What page is yours?
A10112.
Okay, but what I meant to say, not that you weren't clear about the head unit versus the wall station, but when it came time in the Markman to propose a construction, you didn't say anything along the lines of what it sounds like you're asking us to construe today, connected to control or all the circuitry and hardware that might ultimately operate. You never proposed that, did you?
Because that's the express language of the claim. The express language of the claim says a movable barrier operator
connected to control. That may be why, but what is it you would have us do today on claim construction?
I would have you reverse her construction that limits, that imposes this negative requirement that limits the movable barrier operator to the head unit, and instead revert back to the plain language, which just says that a movable barrier operator is met if the components that are recited as comprising that movable barrier operator are connected to control the movement.
What her initial claim construction was? Was it that ordinary meaning, I don't need to limit it to the head unit? What exactly was it?
It was. Her initial claim construction, and this, for the record, is A26, specifically rejected this idea that a movable barrier operator was limited to a head unit.
Did she say affirmatively what the claim construction was?
She said, no construction is required because the claim term is clear and has its plain and ordinary meaning as the words convey. So the words just say, I've got an operator that moves a barrier. That's all I need. And she then goes on to say that The with respect to Nortec's head unit idea, the only time the specification references a head unit is in relation to the movable barrier is as a non-limiting example. And this, Judge Stoll, comes back to your question, a non-limiting example. It is not limiting. And she says it does not justify Nortec's attempt to import claim limitations to narrow the scope of the movable barrier operator. So it's claim construction. She imposed a limitation that is incorrect. I do want to...
I know we're into your time, but when we get to the initial determination, though, by then she's saying at A77 that clarifying that the MBO does not encompass a wall station is readily discernible from the specification. And then she threatens your side, I think, with sanctions for arguing otherwise and trying to broaden the construction. How do we get from point A to point B?
Yes, Sharon, and I certainly want to answer that. I am mindful that I do want to reserve time for the cross-appeal.
To the extent we're asking you questions, we'll give you extra time.
Thank you, because I do want to, I'm here to answer the questions. Yes. So the issue with 77 is what she's doing is she's saying exactly directly opposite to what she said in her Markman order. She's imposing a negative limitation that says these components, the communication connection and the processor, must be in the head unit. If they're not in the head unit, then the claim isn't infringed. And we can actually see that as we walk down through her fact findings. So the reason I say that flipping that construction results in infringement, period, is if you go through her fact findings, this is first with the processor, at A101 to 105, she walks through and she finds that the processor in the wall station, it does identify whether it's a local or a remote command that it's received. And then it does affect closing with or without an alarm based upon that determination. It does what steps C through F say. And then at the bottom of A105 over under the top of A106, she says, summarizing, that the wall station processor in the 404 alternative products appears to determine and affect, using the language of the claim, just as the claim 11 requires. So under the construction, under a construction that does not limit MBO to a head unit, that processor is connected to control the movement exactly as the claim recites. The second thing, though, is with respect to 11B, and the issue around the communication connection, that construction issue also resolves the 11B objection as well. Because 11B recites a number of communication connections, including a wireless communication system connection, which she specifically found was in the wall unit of the Nortec products. And here I'm reading from A83, note 20.
I want to ask you a question about the ruling on the alternative product, no, the original products.
Yes.
And the evidentiary ruling, I guess, or ruling that one of the issues was not properly preserved under the court's ground rules. I believe that's in your main appeal, right?
It is.
Okay. Could you address that a little bit? Give me your best argument for why we shouldn't give her deference, given her ground rule number 10.1 that talks about the level of specificity that you have to have in your post-trial brief in order to preserve issues. And why wasn't the push button, why wasn't she correct in saying, I can't tell what you mean just by push button?
Yeah, let me answer that in two ways. The first is, you don't need to reach that issue at all under the correct construction of MBO, because limitation 11B is met by the Wi-Fi receiver, what's in the language of the claim, the wireless system network connection, wireless network system connection. And here she made a finding. This is at A83 note 20. There's no dispute that the 404 accused products have wireless communication system connections in their wall stations in the form of Wi-Fi receivers. So there's no dispute about that. The only reason she found that wasn't enough to meet a limitation 11B is because she found the movable barrier operator limited to the head unit. So reversing that defaults back to this, and therefore 11B is met independently of the waiver issue based on the Wi-Fi connection. And that we argued in our opening brief at page 45, in our reply brief at pages 52 to 53, that is in the briefing. On the specific issue around the local wired connection, that's an alternative way that 11B could be met, the local wired connection. And there, the decision was an abuse of discretion, Your Honor, that resulted in the ALJ finding facts that she acknowledged and Nortec admitted are contrary to the true facts of the 404 accused products. The ALJ found, and Nortec conceded, that the 404 accused products have a local wired connection as 11B recites, and that all commands, this was Nortec's position, all commands received at the head unit, are transmitted over that local wired connection. That's the true fact. Yet the ALJ found Nortec's products do not infringe 11B's local wired connection, contrary to that fact. And infringement is a finding of fact.
What about the waiver issue, though? The judge still asked you about
it. This was absolutely not waived, Your Honor. It was not waived. The evidence below, and this is from Nortec's own corporate representative witness, we asked him, what happens when you press the button on the wall station? He testified it issues a command that goes over a two-wire connection. It was undisputed that this local wired connection exists and that the only way the head unit can receive a command is over that two-wire connection.
Where does the record show you making the argument that she said was waived? I think that's what we were interested in.
It's at A13835. That's in the post-hearing brief. And in our, that is when we are introduced.
What, 13,000? What?
Yep, it's in two places, Your Honor. The first is A13835.
Yep.
And what we say there, and this is against the backdrop of the only way the head unit can receive a command is over the local wired connection. That is undisputed. We say there's no dispute that Nortec's products distinguish between commands received over the Wi-Fi and commands received from the button on the wall station. We're specifically talking about the head unit receiving commands from the button on the wall station. And the ALJ found, this is at A88, Nortec contended that in the 404 accused products, quote, all the communications relevant to this claim element are received over the same connection, i.e. the local wired connection between the wall station and the head unit. So if the head unit is receiving a command, it is undisputed that it is over that local wired connection.
Is that how you characterize it in your pre-hearing brief?
It is, Your Honor. That is how we talked about it in the pre-hearing.
Talk about the button
brief. We do, Your Honor, because we relied on the testimony.
Can you give us a page site where you said it's the button?
We relied on the testimony of Mr. Null, and I can find the page site. Make sure I'm in the right brief, Your Honor. Sorry about that. And so I'm at Appendix 10619, and we're looking at Claim 11B. In the 404 accused products, the element is met because...
Hang on just a second. We're going to catch up with you.
Sorry.
10619.
Right. 10619. Okay. And so if you go to the Claim Element 11B, it's described as receiving commands via communication connection with the wall station, the local wired connection, and the system wired connection, but the local wired is what we're talking about. And it specifically refers to Dr. Subramanian's infringement report, which those paragraphs that are cited, paragraph 143, for example, refers back to Dr. Subramanian's analysis at paragraphs 89 to 90 of his report. I'll bring you to those in a moment. But that is specifically talking about receiving the command via the local wired connection. And it was undisputed, as I mentioned.
Does the word button appear here in your pre-hearing brief?
It does in the sense that if I go to Dr.
It doesn't literally, correct?
The word button is not on that page, Your Honor. Certainly,
And then the ALJ says
that.
you built this post-hearing on an aside that Dr. Subrahanian made in the course of this lengthy hearing. Why is that an abuse of discretion?
It's an abuse of discretion because it was not an aside. Our theory from the get-go, and I now have, this is Appendix 12-105. This is the portion of Dr. Subrahanian's report where he explains this. And he's saying, in particular, the installation instructs the user to press the wall station's up and down arrow to initiate opening or closing the door, pressing the button to open.
Did he say button?
He says the up or down arrow, which is listed as a button on the wall station. And then he specifically quotes the passage from Mr. Null's testimony that I have been referring to, where Mr. Null testified, so when you press the button, using the word button, when you press the button, that wall station firmware detects that button for us, and it will send over a cycle command to the head unit across the two-wire connection. This is our expert's report before trial. That has been our position since before trial. It was our position at trial. It was our position in the post-trial brief. You press the button. Pressing the button closes the circuit. It causes the command to be sent. And it's sent, the only way to send it, the only way to receive it, is over that two-wire connection.
Now, you rely on those three places in the response, 13,835, 10,619, and 12,105, correct?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. The 12,105 comes...
That's the expert report.
Comes in the expert report, and it's actually in a section that starts at 12100 and walks through each iteration and highlights the wires and where they are.
Stan, one question. On this section we've been talking about, there are all of these, the yellow marking confidential. Do we have to worry about that anymore, or is that
In the appendix in the expert's report, I believe we do have to worry about the yellow being confidential. And what I've read out in open court is from the portion that is not confidential on page 12105.
And also, I think that in your opening brief, you read out some things that were marked as confidential, but are those confidential or not? For example, A13835, the entire page is highlighted in yellow.
I believe that that is not confidential, Your Honor, at this stage. That's what I understood. I tried to avoid getting into anything like specific source code issues, which is where I understand the confidentiality lies.
Okay. I think if you wanted to address your cross appeal, now would be the time. You're well into your rebuttal time. Yes. Do you have something you want to say?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
We had ordered so that we would address the 404 issues on the appeal first, and then I would sit, and then I would come back.
Yes, I'm sorry about that.
Sorry, Your Honor.
That's my bad. Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Dowd. Do you have anything else you want to add? I don't think you have anything else to address.
Not on this, Your Honor. I think Your Honors probably saw in the briefing on the 052 that's expired, and so therefore we'd ask for vacating the invalidity finding on that patent as a result of it expiring during appeal.
Okay. Mr. Day?
May it please the Court. Evan Day for Nortec. I wanted to start with one of the points that Mr. Dowd made recently about the waiver issue, and we disagree with Mr. Dowd's position that the Court doesn't need to raise that issue. And the reason why is it's not just 11B. There are two other elements, 11E and 11F, that depend on the local wired connection, and the ALJ referenced those at Appendix 87. So as long as the ALJ didn't abuse her discretion by finding that there was a change of position by Chamberlain, that waiver finding holds, and that disposes of all of the 404 accused products. Now,
so why isn't it an abuse of discretion? I mean, it seems pretty clear what button means. It doesn't just physically mean the button. It means what's connected to the button and the wires, etc. There's expert support for that. There's testimony from your own witness. Isn't this being a little bit too hyper-technical?
No, Your Honor. And the reason for that specifically has to do with the alternative products, the newer products. Because what Chamberlain was pointing to with respect to the alternative products is they were saying the processor is now the processor in the wall station. And you have claim elements to require that processor to determine that a command was received from a local wired connection, make a determination based on that. Now, the problem is that that wall station processor doesn't receive any commands from the wire that runs from the, at least any commands relevant to this appeal that run between the head unit and the wall station. It sends them, but it doesn't receive them.
I'm having a hard time understanding what benefit they have from... you make this argument that they had an intent, I guess, or had some benefit to be gained by just arguing the button.
That's well.
I'm having a hard time understanding that.
Certainly, and I'll explain that, Your Honor.
Okay.
The benefit to Chamberlain was making an infringement case based on the processor in the wall station of the alternative products. Because now you can say that the processor in the wall station is detecting button presses. So if the local wire connection is the button itself rather than the wire, you can say that you've received a command from that button press. And now you're making the determinations you need in elements 11E and 11F because you've received it from the button press.
It doesn't the processor, even when it's in the head unit, it's going to receive some indication of whether the button's impressed, regardless of the location of the processor, whether it's in the wall unit or in the head unit?
The processor on the head unit is, Your Honor, but for the alternative products, Chamberlain's theory was based on the processor in the wall station.
I understand, but I don't understand why for the original products it benefits them to argue buttons over wires connected to the buttons or a combination of the buttons and the wires, you know, to somehow further their argument on infringement for the alternative products. And I'm just trying to understand that.
I think that might be correct for the original products, but I think Chamberlain wanted an exclusion order that would have kept the alternative products out as well. So that's why they moved to a different theory.
But this argument that they had an incentive to suddenly and belatedly call out the button to capture the alternative products, it did carry the risk, even you would concede that they might lose the case with respect to the original products.
That's exactly what happened, Your Honor.
Okay, and I guess that just makes it harder for us, or at least me, to understand why that would have been their motivation. For trying to play fast and loose with the ground rules. Can you help us on that?
To be quite fair, I think that really seems to be the question about motivation seems to be more one for opposing counsel, but they did change their theory, and there was a reason for them to do that.
But you're the ones who said that was their motivation.
Yeah, that's
okay,
right.
Okay, so that's why we're asking you about what is it. Help me understand why you can surmise that that's their motivation.
Because that gives them an argument on the alternative product. What exactly is the argument?
The argument is that the buttons, since the buttons are in the same place as the processor, it's okay then that the processor isn't part of the head unit?
I believe that's it, Your Honor. But I think the reason for the change is that because the processor is in the processor in the wall station isn't getting anything over the wire, you can now say that doesn't matter because it's still receiving commands from the button. Now, could they have made an argument based on the processor in the head unit for the alternative products? I don't know. They chose not to at the hearing. And I'd also point out that Mr. Dowd said a couple of times that movable barrier operates.
There's local wired connection, system wired connection, network connection. There's a lot of different connections that the buttons could have been connected to the processor here, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you.
So with respect to the claim construction issue, that last point that we've been talking about, the processor in the wall station not receiving commands from that local wire connection, it gets to another point that Mr. Dowd said a couple of times. So Mr. Dowd said that the construction of the movable barrier operator would resolve everything. Nortec disagrees with that because you still have claim elements 11E and 11F that require the processor to receive commands from the local wired connection. And even adopting Chamberlain's construction wouldn't fix that problem for them. There's still no infringement of those elements. So
what is your view then? Your view is that even if we adopted the claim construction, we could only vacate and remand? Or is your view that we should consider those alternative arguments?
Well, there weren't even alternative arguments made. Chamberlain's brief doesn't even raise...
But what would be the disposition? That's what I'm trying to ask you. What are you arguing for a disposition? Just so I understand, were the court to say that the claim construction was incorrect, what should our disposition be according to you?
That the case is still affirmed because Chamberlain's brief doesn't spell out a reason to reverse on elements 11E and 11F. Even the doctrine of equivalence argument doesn't address the local case. It only talks about the remote case where the user is using something like a smartphone.
Did the court below address those elements?
Yes, they did, Your Honor. I believe that was discussed in Appendix 105 through 109. We're discussing the DOE arguments. And she also pointed out that they weren't, there was not, at Appendix 104, there weren't any arguments raised with respect to element 11E. And with all that being said, the judge's construction, if you want to call it that, whether you want to call it instruction or application of plain and ordinary meaning, either way, it's right. Now, the title of this patent is movable barrier operator and transmitter for with the barrier notification. And the claims consistently refer to both the movable barrier operator and the transmitter in various ways that the movable barrier operator can process what it's receiving from the transmitter based on either the content or...
What is your view on whether the removable barrier operator has to be housed in one location?
It does, Your Honor, because the movable barrier operator... Our view, the movable barrier operator is a structure. Now, you asked about housing. The claim doesn't say housing, but it does refer to the movable barrier operator as a structure rather than strictly a functional component.
Do you know of any cases? Well, let me ask you this. You're saying because it's a structure, it has to be all in one physical place.
That's right, Your Honor.
And can you tell me what is your best evidence for that? I mean, is it the figures for how they show one blank box for it, or what is it?
The figures, that would certainly be one. Figure one, how it shows a single box. I would also point to figure five, which shows the movable barrier operator and the transmitter as separate components and the corresponding discussion. And
what about, you know, we've got plenty of cases that say, you know, just because there's a blank box doesn't mean there aren't multiple elements within that box.
That's certainly true, Your Honor. But what the figures in figures one and five, they're not just showing a blank box. They're also showing the transmitter.
So you're saying because the transmitter is in a separate box from the movable barrier operator, that means that the claim should be read to say they can't be housed in the same place or distributed.
I think that's correct.
Is there anything in the specification that talks about the importance of having the movable barrier operator be separate from the buttons?
Well, the entire focus of this patent is how the movable barrier operator processes commands from a transmitter.
Isn't it the entire focus of it is whether it's going to turn an alarm on or off depending on whether it's receiving a signal locally or whether it's receiving a signal that's not local?
That's fair, Your Honor, but it is a signal from a transmitter, and the claims and specification consistently talk about the MBO and the transmitter separately. And to be fair, the transmitter isn't mentioned in Claim 11, but it is in some of the others.
And the transmitter isn't in the wall unit, right?
The wall unit would be an example of a transmitter. And
the transmitter, you're saying that's, well, I thought the transmitter was like a remote control or your phone or something like that. And the wall unit was wired. Am I wrong? Is that not how your patent specification describes it?
So the transmitter can be wired, and actually in figure 5, there's an example, 552, there's a line 552 it's called out as a wired transmitter. And I see that I'm well into my rebuttal time, Your Honor, unless there are further questions on the 404.
I do have one. Okay. I mean, I read to your friend on the other side from page A77. The ALJ said that the movable barrier operator does not encompass a wall station, which you would agree with, and she says that's readily discernible from the specification. Does she ever tell us anywhere in the record where in the specification that's readily discernible from?
She looks at the she points to the figure. And
figure five on the figure
five. I apologize. Actually, the ALJ pointed to figure 1. I think figure 5 is a little bit more clear.
You're saying she points to figure 1? Where does she point to figure 1?
That's at appendix 76.
I get it. It's her figure 5 is figure 1 from the patent. Is that right?
That's right. Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. But is it anything more than what you've just recited in response to Judge Stoll's questions? Is there something more in the specification that would make it readily discernible that the MBO does not include the wall station?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think that was the ALJ cited the same evidence in the specification.
And how do you explain what happened? Because you had proposed a construction at the Markman stage that would have limited the MBO to the head unit. And she said that's merely an exemplary embodiment and rejected that. So how do we get from the margin to the initial determination? They don't seem to line up.
So I think what the ALJ was saying at the Markman, and unfortunately there were only parallel briefs, there wasn't a hearing, which may have resulted in some ambiguity. But what she said in the Markman was it doesn't have to be a garage door opener head unit. There are other embodiments. And at the time the Markman was taking place, there actually were some other types of operators. There were gate operators that were accused. What the ALJ was saying in the Markman hearing is it doesn't have to be that specific type of operator, but she was not saying that the operator can include anything else that you see in those figures. Are there any further questions on the 404?
No.
Okay. Moving on to the cross appeal on the 223, the fundamental problem with the commission's interpretation or construction of the term operates in the 223 patent is that they read it out of the claim. Claims 1 and 21 of the 223 patent require that the obstacle detector operates using a first and second energy usage. So operates and the energy usage are both part of the claim, and the commission adopted a construction, particularly at appendix 354 to 55, that collapsed those into a single element. The problem with that is you don't have the word operates is no longer doing anything in that claim. There's the way that they've interpreted that, there's no such thing as not operating. When you say that if it can be completely off, you could never have an obstacle detector that does not operate. We cited the case law in a brief, the effect that when you have different claim elements, they're presumed to mean different things and convey additional meaning to the claim. Additionally, the commission adopted that position that operates and the first and second energy usage could mean completely off in the face of the parties agreeing that it could not mean that. Both experts said operates can't be completely off, and Chamberlain.
But even the expert saying it can't be completely off, how much weight should that be given?
I think that's a considerable amount of weight because it's very, you don't see that sort of agreement very often.
What about in the context of the specification? I'm just curious. Were they talking about in the context of the specification when they said that?
Yes, I believe so, Your Honor. And I think both experts pointed to examples in the specification where there were where the obstacle detectors weren't completely powered, so the actual disagreements for over infringement were whether the obstacle detectors in the accused products were doing something else when they weren't fully powered.
But there's never a time where the accused products are fully turned off. There's always some power, you're saying.
There's not power that's doing anything.
But there's power, some kind of, in other words, there's if one read the item, there would be an indication of some power in it, leaving aside whether it's doing anything or not.
There's a very trivial amount of power. Now, with respect to the domestic industry, the technical domestic industry products, the ALJ found that Chamberlain hadn't even proved that because the amount of power is within the measuring error of their instrument. There's a very trivial amount of current trickling through the...
Current, but the device isn't doing anything.
Right. And what the ALJ found, the basis for her non-infringement finding, was that there is undisputed evidence from the Nortec technical witness, as well as its expert, that there is nothing being done, but the devices weren't operating, the obstacle detectors weren't operating on that amount of power, and as well as just a failure proof by Chamberlain that they hadn't actually shown evidence that they were operating. And I've gone well over my time. I don't know if there are any additional questions on the 223.
No, I think we're okay. Thank you. Just while we're waiting for this to be set up, I do want to ask you one more question, Mr. Day. In your view, is there any information in the record that remains confidential?
The only things that we would say remain confidential at this point would be references to like specific lines and functions of source code. Now, the briefs are not confidential. We agree with that. And the way that everything's been everything in the record that describes these things at a functional level is non-confidential.
Only source code is confidential.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Only code.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you, and I appreciate the court's allowing me to appear remotely. May it please the court, neither party has identified any actual error in the commission's construction or any real error in its factual findings. Instead, both Chamberlain and Nortec are pursuing what are basically positions that are contrary to the claim language and the specification. Starting with the 404 patent, for example, Chamberlain wants to take the position that movable barrier operator is essentially a functional term and it can mean almost whatever it means in any given situation. So long as it can identify a processor and a wire somewhere in a garage door system. Well, that's just not the way the claims are written. There's no reason to find the movable barrier operator to be such a broad functional term. Otherwise, we'd be in 112.6 land, which actually helps the commission's position. Claim 11, to start at the beginning, is directed to a processor, and that processor is part of the movable barrier operator, and that operator is part of the larger movable barrier system. Now, the movable barrier operator has various connections, wired connection and connections to antennas and so forth. Some of those connections are to local sources, some of them are to remote sources. But the specification makes clear, especially figures 1 and 2, that the movable barrier operator does not include what's on the other side of, say, the local wired connection or the other connection.
Why doesn't this violate our case law that says we're not going to read embodiments into the claims? There's nothing in the claim that says the movable barrier operator has to be in a particular location, right?
Except the claims always have to be read in the context of the specification. And movable barrier operators, it's not a term found in the dictionary. We have to understand it in this context. And I also want to address
but,
the issue.
But your view is that the specification makes it important that it be located in the head unit and not, I might read the spec and think that it makes it important what it does. You know, it's the specification talking more about the functions, what it's connected to, not necessarily where it's located. how would you respond to that? Why do you think the patent specification makes its location so important?
Well, I don't think it's location per se, because the patent is directed to both garage door systems, which has been the focus so far, but it also includes gate operator systems, which were originally accused products, but they've dropped out. So when the judge, for example, said that the movable barrier operator was not limited to a head unit, what she was saying was it can be a head unit in a garage door system, but it can also be something else in a gate operator system, which does not have a ceiling-mounted unit. And if we look in the patent as well, and if we compare figures 1 and 2, figure 1 shows the movable barrier operator. It's kind of the traditional ceiling-mounted head unit that we're probably all familiar with. Figure 2 is somewhat more abstract. It doesn't identify the movable barrier operator as being in a particular location. But what it does show is that there's connections to the operator, but the wall station is outside the movable barrier operator. The wall station is connected to it by a cable, as it is in the figure one and other figures that Nortech's counsel mentioned. So
are you familiar with anything else? One of the questions that Judge Stark asked was, besides figures 1 and 2, is there anything else in the patent that the judge relied on for her claim construction, or that you think we should consider for the claim construction? Again, just talking about from the specification.
In the specification, I would look to column 5, line 36, to column 6, line 7. There it describes the movable barrier operator being separate from the wall station. It receives commands from the wall station over a wired connection. Well, if they're connected and they're described as being separate components, then they should be treated separately. Also, column 8, line 45, to column 9, line 29. Again, it describes the movable barrier operator and the wall station being separate components. And to Chamberlain's point, you know, just because a movable barrier operator in the claim is identified as having a processor and a connection, it doesn't mean it includes everything within the larger movable barrier system. You know, there has to be some affirmative evidence to that fact, and the patent points in the opposite direction. The wall station is separate from the movable barrier operator.
Is there, is there anything in the specification that tells us we should not read everything that you just referenced as just exemplary embodiments?
Well, they're embodiments, I think, for the garage door system. Now, if we talk about gate systems, it may be a very different system.
No, I mean, even if we just limit it to garage door systems, I don't see anything in the specification that says my claims are limited in garage door systems to this type of structure or setup, but I'm trying to find if I'm missing something.
I guess we would. What would happen is if we had a queue system with a wall station and a wire running to the barrier operator, if we followed the spec, we'd say they're separate, but if we're going to construe the term differently, we would say they're the same. I mean, it just gets confusing because it's the same structure at issue. We're not talked about different types of wall stations or different types of connections. It's the same setup, and it's clearly described in the spec that these are two separate things, and they're connected by the local wire connection or a connecting wire, as the case may be. The judge, I'd like to say something about her Markman opinion. It was Chamberlain who asked her to adopt just the plain meaning, and that's what she did. She didn't feel needed any further explanation. And in her opinion, she distinguished the movable barrier operator from the larger movable barrier system. But then when she went to say the head unit is a non-limiting example, I think you have to understand there's two things at issue here. One, the head unit is an example of a movable barrier operator, and that's true for garage door systems, as I said. But it's a non-limiting example because it, the patent also covers gate operators, as I said. So there's no basis to jump to the conclusion that just because it's not limited to a head unit in every case, that therefore the operator covers everything in the garage. I mean, there's no
affirmative evidence of that. That distinction, I think, maybe makes some sense, but is there anything we can point to in the record to understand that that's what the ALJ was saying when she said at Markman it's not limiting?
Her Markman opinion itself, I think, was pretty brief, and I I think she was just stating the opinions. I think she elaborated that later when she, in the footnote that was referenced, she felt Chamberlain was trying to change his claim construction by then arguing that the operator included the wall stage. She said, no, that wasn't part of the briefing for the Markman proceeding. I think that's a problem we have here, too, with both parties, frankly, is both of the claim terms at issue in these two patents were submitted to the judge for resolution. She construed them, and then both parties down the road say, oh, no, there's additional elements that have to be part of that claim construction. Either you have to construe the operator in the wall station in case of the 404, or Nortek says, oh, no, no, operate means you have to have some minimal energy level. Those issues weren't raised in the Markman proceeding, and so for purposes of review, we think they should fall under the heading of substantial evidence and infringement analysis and not give the parties another bite at
claim. But isn't it a claim construction? I mean, that interpretation, like I think it's at page A75 of the record, where the judge said that the movable barrier operator cannot include a wall station, that's a claim construction, right? I mean, you know, I personally would not think that, I would think the trial judge could change his or her claim construction. I don't know why they couldn't if they had additional thought and, you know, during the course of the trial discovered, hey, I need to further construe this. The question really is whether the claim construction is right or wrong. That's what we look at on appeal. But are you seriously disputing that that's a claim construction?
I think she's clarifying what position she took when she said it's not limited to a head unit. She said
that's right, but it's a claim construction, right? That's my question.
It's claim construction, but I feel the parties are trying to go around the Markman proceeding and insert claim limitations that they didn't raise.
Well, one party argued that the movable barrier operator had to be in the head unit, and one party argued that that's not correct, and Jay considered that. And, you know, it's fine for her to reconsider her opinion, but I don't understand why you think that more had to be done to preserve the argument on the behalf of the appellant. Could you explain that for me?
I'm saying that for purposes of review, we think it's not a subject of an oval review. I think it also goes to how do we apply these terms once you adopt the plain and ordinary meaning? How do you apply it to a garage system?
But she never did that, right? I mean, she interpreted the claim term and then did not consider the other issues. She said, I'm interpreting this term to mean that that the processor can't be in the wall unit. It has to be in the head unit. And so therefore, you know, no infringement, right?
That's essentially correct, yes.
Okay, so it would not be for us to, if we thought the claim construction was incorrect, it would not be for us then to make a factual determination on infringement, right?
Well, the fact is where the processor is, I mean, that's correct.
Thank you.
But turning to Nortek's original products, there was some discussion of this waiver. We would simply direct the court's attention to what Chamberlain itself said in its post-hearing brief. There's at least half a dozen references to identifying the button as the local wire connection, and they're at Appendix 13841, 13842, 13843, 13844, 13848, 13849, and 13851. And they consistently say the button is the local wire connection. And the reason this works, and we're not just trying to be difficult, is when Chamberlain argues that the movable barrier operator extends all the way out to the wall station, then it needs a local connection to that wall station, which is the button. The connecting wire between the two is no longer the thing that's going to send the closed door command to the processor in the wall station. And the fact that Chamberlain didn't even mention it, and now we're spending an inordinate amount of time describing how the thing works, just shows what's not present in their own post-hearing brief. And the commission was in its rights to rely on what they argued. We understood their position to be that the movable barrier operator extends all the way out to the wall station. and we understood their position to be that the button was the local wired connection.
But what they meant by button has to be understood in context, doesn't it? The context including the expert report, the hearing, and everything that had been said before about what the button was connected to.
Well, if we're talking about how it works, that might be true, but we're talking about trying to match specific components to claim limitations, and these claim limitations are all interrelated. If we change the boundary of the movable barrier operator, say from a head unit out to the wall station, well, that changes what we might consider the local wired connection to be, or what some of the other components might be. We're not just talking about how it works, and I think that kind of gets lost in this discussion. Chamberlain has the obligation to identify what component matches to each claim limitation, either literally or by equivalence. And the commission relies on the briefing to understand what that argument is. You know, we don't necessarily fill in the blanks with the briefs where we think it's convenient. It's not fair to the other party. So we take them at their word. Turning to the alternative products, there's no literal infringement because in that case, the processor in the wall station performs the functions of the claim. And as I argued earlier, that wall station is not part of the barrier operator. And the button to that wall station then is not the local wired connection to the movable barrier operator when that term is properly understood because it's not connected to it. As far as doctrine equivalence, Chamberlain relies on the testimony of Nortec's engineer, Mr. Null, but the commission found his testimony unpersuasive on that point. Mr. Null was essentially responding to a leading question from the attorney. He was asked to compare essentially a two-step programming system in the alternative product to the one-step software in the original products. He wasn't even asked to compare the accused products to the claim language, so it wasn't even a valid equivalence analysis. And what's more, Mr. Null just gave a one-word response to the attorney's argument, affirming that this attorney's statement was correct, but it's not clear he even understood what equivalence was, or as I said, it wasn't even a proper equivalence analysis. So
thank you, Mr. Brecher. I think your time is up. If you want, you can say conclusion sentence.
I'm sorry.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Dowd, I will give you, it looks like you have your time there. Go ahead. Thank you.
Sorry, that was me as well. Apologies.
You're out of time, but I will give you 5 minutes to address the cross appeal.
Thank you, Your Honor. And if I might, can I briefly respond to some of the points on the 404
yes,
as well?
5 minutes.
Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, one question I have. Mr. Day pointed out that even if there was no waiver, you still have a problem with respect to claims 11E and 11F.
I believe it was 11D and 11F, Your Honor, because those are the ones that talk about the determining and affecting. And there is no problem on that under the correct construction of MBO, because if Your Honor takes a look and walks through the fact findings that the judge made, and this is at pages starting on 101, she walks through with respect to when the user presses the wall station button on the alternative product, the wall station processor, and then it walks through all of the things that the wall station processor does. And what she finds is that it determines whether it was local or remote, and then it affects closing either with an alarm or without an alarm based on that determination. And she summarizes.
What about the non-alternative products?
For the non-alternative products, there was no dispute. For the original and for the private label product, she found that the head unit processor did all of those elements, and there is no dispute. So that means that if the claim construction is reversed, that ends the inquiry, and you can affirm based on the findings that she did make, including at 101 through 106. On the question, there was a question about what benefit would we gain from changing our argument. Absolutely no benefit at all. We would gain no benefit from that. It would only be
I think the argument was somehow by that you had a motivation to focus on the button because then the button would be in the wall unit and it would support your argument on the alternative products.
But I
think he was even in the ALJ's decision. So.
But if you take a look back to what the claim actually says, this is with respect to the limitation 11B. And the claim says the movable barrier operator comprising a communication connection, and one of those connections is the wireless communication system connection. She has a finding that that's met. So we gain nothing. We don't need to argue anything about a button to be able, we don't need to change our position. Because our position is that if MBO is correctly construed, that limitation is met either way, either local wired or by the wireless system network. There is nothing in the patent that says it has to be inside of a box. I think your honors are very well familiar with the cases on Wired Planets, Super Guide, Sea Change that we cite in our brief that says you can't import limitations from the claim. That is what was done. I do want to turn to the operates limitation, and in the very short amount of time that I have, what happened here is, after careful review, the commission agreed with and adopted the original construction of operates from the Markman order, applied that, and found, as a result of that, there was infringement. That construction is supported both by the claim language in claims 1 and 21 that talks about there's simply two modes of operation that are distinguished based on energy usage. There's nothing in that language that says that you have to perform work or perform a function. And the work or function that Nortec is talking about is detecting an obstacle. There is nothing in the claim that says you have to perform work or do a function. It just has to be lower energy mode. And claim 7, I think, the dependent claim that depends from claim 1, I think it's dispositive on this issue. It says that in the low power mode, relatively infrequent energization comprises substantially no energization. That means that claim 1 must encompass an obstacle detector with substantially no energization of its obstacle sensor, of the photo beam. The photo beam of an obstacle detector, if you think about a garage, that is the thing that does the work or the function of the obstacle detector. And this is saying that can be fully off. So there is no requirement for works or functions in the claim. Very briefly, that is also supported in the specification. This is at column 10, lines 13 to 16, where it specifically says a photo beam-based obstacle detector 12, that's the whole detector, can be configured to permit reduction of the energization cycle and or complete powering down. So the construction that the commission applied is fully supported on the intrinsic record, and we would submit that it should be affirmed. Unless there are other questions, I'll
thank you, Mr. Bell.
Thank you.
Mr. Day, I will give you 3 minutes.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. So with respect to the original Markman order, what the original Markman order did not say was that operates could be off or that it was collapsed into energy usage such that those were the same limitation without operates giving any additional meaning to the claim. Additionally, with respect to Claim 7, I'd point the court to what Chamberlain's own expert said at Appendix 1675, that substantially no energization can't be completely off. That was their own expert's testimony. Additionally, with respect to Claim 7 talks about no energization of an obstacle sensor. It doesn't talk about no energization of an obstacle detector. Now, Chamberlain's entire infringement theory during the case was that the obstacle detector was doing something else. There's in a sleep mode without the sensor itself being on. So they made that distinction. And just to be clear, what the original Markman order did say, now it did say that the that the obstacle detector didn't have to perform its primary function. And we're not arguing that on appeal. So Chamberlain took the position in the hearing that it could be something other than its primary function, specifically that it was in a low-powered sleep mode that would allow it to wake up really quickly. The ALJ just found that they failed to prove that. But the ALJ was correct in applying the plain and ordinary meaning of the word operates. It has to operate. Operate cannot mean not operate. With respect to the specification also doesn't say that operate can mean not operate. Mr. Dowd pointed to column 10. Now, column 10, it refers to accommodating a reduced energy consumption mode of operation. Further down in column 10 in the claim, that reduced energy mode of consumption operation is associated with the MBO itself, not with the obstacle detector. And finally, at the end of that passage that Mr. Dowd pointed to, the options for the obstacle detector, it can be completely powered down, or it can be put in a reduced operating mode, but only one of those, in only one of those does it still operate, and that's what the claim requires. So unless there are any further questions from the court.
No, there isn't. Thank you. The case is submitted. We thank both counsel for their argument.